supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family every day, every minute of every day, from the time we get up to the time we go to sleep. We are making choices about our lives. Some are simple. What do we eat for breakfast? Others can be much bigger. Should I get married? Should I stay in this marriage? What should I do with the rest of my life? So choosing can make us feel liberated and free and in control of our lives. At other times, it can raise our anxiety. But do we really understand what drives our decision and what makes us choose the way we do? Well, to help us better understand the mysteries surrounding choice is Sheila Iyengar. She is one of the world's leading experts on choice and a professor at Columbia University Business School in New York City. Her new book, The Art of Choosing, explores the biology and psychology behind choice and how different cultures make decisions and what we can do to make better choices. Sheena is joining us by telephone today from New York City. Sheena, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
We also want to hear from you, our listeners out there. Tell us what goes into your decisions, which are more stressful, which are less stressful. How do you make choices, and how do you feel when facing big and small decisions? Our number is 888-477-9499. Sheena, how did you get interested in this choice business?
I think I've been thinking about choice since I was a very young child. I mean, I was born the child of Sikh immigrants to this country, and so I was constantly going back and forth between two different ideas about choice, because at home I grew up in a very traditional Sikh home, and that meant that you understood your duties, your responsibilities, so, you know, you never cut your hair and you dressed conservatively and marriages were arranged and your careers were often guided heavily by your parents or those those who had greater experience. And then on the other hand, I was going to American schools that taught me the value of personal preference. You're supposed to decide what you're going to wear, what you're going to eat, and was considered to be really horrific, the idea that, you know, my parents had an arranged marriage and they met each other on their wedding day, and that was considered really awful. And so I was constantly having to go back and forth and debate in my own mind as to how much did I value personal preference.
Would it be an oversimplification to ask you which culture you liked more as a child?
So I think that's what I kept trying to do when I was growing up, is trying to decide which one I wanted to be more of a member of. And I think I realized at some point in time, which I can't define, that essentially I go back and forth between the two and probably will for the rest of my life. I think I see by seeing the two choices in an odd way, I understand better the trade-off.
Which is?
There are some benefits to thinking of your life in terms of duty. In some cases, it actually makes things a lot easier. And there are some benefits to thinking and valuing personal preference, because that opens up more possibilities for you.
You make a case in your book that choice is innate within us, or the desire for choice is innate within us.
Mm-hmm.
Why the biology? Why that drive for choice?
Well, we all want control over our lives. I mean, no people have ever throughout time, no animals, no people have ever asked for anybody to come in and conquer them. And that we seem to be innately wired for. So, you know, even a baby that can't even speak yet, you know, an infant, you know, just like a month out, you put up a music mobile on top of their crib, and in one case, the music mobile goes off by itself and makes these beautiful sounds and shows beautiful lights. And in another case, every time the child accidentally hits the music mobile, if that turns on the music and the lights, the kids just love it a lot more. There's this innate desire that I want to be in control over my environment.
So that's what we want. We want control over our environment and our surroundings. And I guess that's a dance we do for the rest of our lives, because, you know, as a clinician, I treat people, well, even my friends and colleagues, they do that dance. They want more control over their lives than they have.
Well, we want control over our lives, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we always want the burden of choice.
Ah, say more.
So we want to feel that we are in control, but sometimes if we have to make a difficult choice that can feel really burdensome, can even make us feel out of control, in which case we don't want choice, which is the main tool to exercise control over our life. So we want to feel control in the mind. And that's actually ultimately more important than always being the one who makes the choices. Not that I'm saying that we would all want to have no choice. Clearly we want choice more than zero choice. But that choice doesn't always mean that we're going to feel in control.
Yeah, and if I can take a little leap in what you're saying, it almost sounds like what we need, what we want, is to feel enough in control so that we can give up some control to other people when need be.
Sometimes that's certainly true. You know, sometimes they even find that, you know, take for example elderly patients in a nursing home. You know, often as we get older, we're losing control over our lives, and that's something we've gotten used to, and and they see themselves deteriorating, and that can be emotionally and physically really taxing on people. They become depressed, they become less healthy. And sometimes if you take elderly patients in a nursing home and give them really trivial choices, you know, like what night of the week would you like to watch a movie and how would you like to take care of a plant in your room, they find that just giving these people these very simple choices can make a big difference. They become happier, they become healthier. They even found that they can live an average of 6 months longer.
In your book, you bring up various studies to help illustrate the many factors affecting how we choose, when we choose, and of course, the classic study is the marshmallow study with small children, and it really does touch on self-control and how we manage our impulses. Give us a summary of this study and what it suggests.
One of my favorite studies. Walter Mischel, one of the probably 10 most famous psychologists of the 20th century, he did a study way back in the 1960s where he brought 3- and 4-year-olds into the lab, and he showed them a marshmallow and another marshmallow, and he said, "Look, do you want to eat a marshmallow?" And they said, "Yes." "Do you want to eat one marshmallow or two marshmallows?" And they all said they wanted to eat two marshmallows. And he said, "All right, well, I'm going to put this marshmallow right here, and if you can wait till I come back, then you'll get two of them. But if you can't wait, then you ring the bell and I'll come back, but then you'll only get one marshmallow." And we all understand that having two is better than one. And what they found was that most kids couldn't wait. You know, of course, it was actually in reality, they had to wait 15 minutes. And they couldn't wait. The few kids, though, that were able to wait and actually got the two marshmallows ended up doing much better in life and on a whole host of different measures. They were better in school, they were better in their SAT scores, they got into better colleges, they went on to have pursue higher education, generally had healthier lives, greater income in their lives. So on a whole, they were followed until about 45 years of age. And so these people that had learned how to delay gratification at such a young age, that had really helped them through life.
And these people who did well in life, I imagine, were also found a way to stay away from sadistic researchers who tortured kids with marshmallows.
I don't know, recently they've actually subjected themselves to go under MRI machines. That's the latest study Walter Mischel is doing. So they've actually allowed their minds now to be put under the microscope.
Marshmallows are better. So some can resist the marshmallow and exercise self-control. And what you're saying is they are in a minority.
They are, but their techniques that they use on themselves, we can all benefit from.
Does That simply suggests that we are better off exercising self-control. And if so, what does that say about spontaneity?
Well, definitely, whenever we are struggling, we're in that great debate in our minds, should I have that cake or not? Should I put my money away for tomorrow or buy myself that dress or that iPhone or whatever it is that we're desperately wanting to? And the way we rationalize to ourselves is, yeah, it's really important to not to, you know, take care of my health or to save more for tomorrow. But, you know, then what's worth it in life? I mean, is life really worth living if I'm going to make myself so boring, et cetera, right? And that's inherently the struggle we're always having with ourselves. Essentially, you have to be, in order to really maximize on everything, you essentially need to be self-controlled, even about giving yourself spontaneity, if I can be so abstract. You know, if you forever give in to temptation, on any given temptation, it's not a big deal. But it's so easy to let all those temptation decisions add up, and then you wake up one morning and realize you actually didn't save a dime in the bank account, and you actually gained about 15 pounds.
Right. So the deal is, don't act on your desire until you've reflected.
Your reflection should guide your automatic impulses, yeah. Not the other way around.
I love quoting the title of a book by Sylvia Boorstein, who's a Buddhist and a great thinker, and the title of her book is Don't Just Do Something, Sit There, which is a great approach to managing our impulses. We're talking with Sheena Iyengar, and she's one of the world's leading experts on choice. Her book is called The Art of Choosing. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call and tell us what goes into your choices, both big and small, maybe even what choices you're struggling with now. 888-477-9499. Let's go to Naomi, who's on the phone. Naomi, hi, you're on Voices. Hello? I guess we'll have to find Naomi later in the show. So you lay out an idea in your book that we want choice, but we're happier when choices are limited.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that? You know, my thought went to the first time I went into Baskin-Robbins. You know, I went from 4 or 5 flavors of ice cream, and I saw 31. And I remember feeling both excited and confused at the same time. You know, so all of a sudden, now which is the right choice? Which should I have? That word should came into my head. So, you know, I felt excited and distressed at the same time.
You know, that's a great story. It turns out that 31 flavors was actually what put Baskin and Robbins on the map. I mean, it really helped boost their sales. But what's fascinating about ice cream preferences, even today, after we've gotten used to a heck of a lot more than 31 flavors, is even today, 50% of U.S. ice cream sales are accounted for by plain vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry, even though we've been exposed to so many more flavors. So one of the things is that we want a lot of choice. But when we actually have all that choice, we don't know what to choose. And we often either choose not to choose or choose some sort of a default or what's familiar to us.
Yeah, I think of TV, you know, and they're arguing now, Comcast, Verizon, whatever these networks are, that I've got 300 channels, 400, 500. I don't even know what channels I have. You know, mm-hmm. But I wind up watching the same handful or maybe even less than a handful.
I would say the same thing is true with me too, right? I have over 1,000 channels, but the only thing that gets turned on is either the news channel or whatever it is that my son likes to watch.
Yeah, I'll watch a news channel depending on what's going on in the world. Sometimes it's just too scary. I have to tell you, Sheena, one of my favorite studies was the marshmallow study.
Mm-hmm.
Until I read about your study, your jam study that you conducted as a PhD student. It's a wonderful study that any retailer really should know about. Tell us about it.
Well, when I was a PhD student, there was this fancy upscale grocery store that was right by campus. It was called Drager's Grocery Store, and there's lots of stores like it today. At the time, it was a little more of a novelty, but it had like 250 mustards and vinegars and over 500 different kinds of fruits and vegetables. It really sold choice. And people would go there for all the varieties that they offered. And I would go there, and it was like almost like going into an amusement park every time you went in there with all the varieties. But I found that I almost never bought anything. And so I went and approached the manager, and I asked him whether the model was working, and we decided to do a study. And what we did was we put out a tasting booth where we either had 6 different flavors of jam or 24 different flavors of jam, and they were all from the same brand. And we first looked at in which case were people more likely to get attracted to the tasting booth, stop, and sample some jam. And when there were 6 jams on display, only 40% of the passersby stopped. But when there were 24, 60% of the people who entered the store stopped and sampled some jam. Well, then what we did was we gave customers a coupon, giving them $1 off. And we wanted to see in which case were people more likely to buy a jar of jam. And what we found is that of the people who stopped when there were 24 flavors of jam, only 3% of them actually bought a jar of jam. Of the people who stopped when there were 6 different flavors of jam on display, 30% of them actually bought a jar of jam. So while people were more attracted to the larger display of jams, they were attracted to it, they thought it was cool, when it came down to buying, people were more than 6 times more likely to buy a jar of jam if they saw 6 than if they saw 24.
Well, that brings me back to the question I asked, maybe the first question of our show today, when you were talking about growing up in Sikh parents, with Sikh parents where choice was limited, and versus in America, I think it was Queens, yes?
Yes, it was in Flushing, yes.
Okay, where obviously choice was valued. And I asked, what I wanted to ask, I asked you which you liked better. The full question I wanted to ask is, which did you like better and which felt better? Which appealed to your head and which appealed to your viscera?
Well, I think I like the American ideology better.
Yeah.
But I think I over time realized that there were a lot of comforts associated with the Sikh ideology. And you know, I think the idea of duties and responsibilities highlights another very important part of choice, which we often, you know, sweep under the rug or don't pay as much attention to, which is that choice has limitations. And I think, you know, even though I pose it as two contrasting models of choice between the Sikhs and the Americans, I think all of us, even as Americans, even though we might put greater emphasis on the possibilities associated with choice, we all have to balance choice in terms of its possibilities and choice in terms of its limitations. And I think being a Sikh highlighted for me the limitations.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Naomi, who's been patient enough to try us again. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, how are you again today, Dr. Dan? This is very interesting, and I'm just so delighted that you're doing this. I've had a lot of hard time making choices in my life. One of my parents was very authoritative, and the other was very liberal with everything, and I always felt as a child that I was making the wrong decision. And even now, small choices are hard, from eating at a restaurant and taking 20 minutes to order, to what should I watch on TV, to so many different things. What kind of tips could you give about making choices and how to train yourself to be more comfortable making choices.
Can I ask you a question before we turn it to Sheena?
Sure.
What are you scared of, Naomi?
Making the wrong choice.
Let me ask it again. What are you scared of?
That I'm going to miss out on one side. If I pick A, that will be a good side, but B would have been even better.
All right,
why I love to go to buffets instead.
All right, let me ask it. Let me ask it a third time. So you're afraid you'll miss out on B? I'll ask it again. What are you afraid of?
Not being satisfied.
Huh? Are you?
I don't know. This is with almost every aspect of my life. I'm 24 right now, and almost every aspect I feel the same difficulty.
Well,
if someone else could make the decision for me, I would be happy.
All right. Now, Sheena, you've got to help. You've got to help Naomi. You've got to help me, because now I'm confused. Because I'll tell you where Sheena took me. Where Sheena took me is that ultimately... I mean, where Naomi took me, is that ultimately she's afraid of not being satisfied. But she's already not satisfied. So she's afraid of being where she is. So can you help us both?
So I would say what I tell my students all the time is you have to be choosy about your choosing. Because we have to make choices about everything today, ranging from your eye color to your career. And you can't possibly optimize or maximize on all of those things. I mean, we've gotten to the point where we think every single choice is important and that we need to make all our own choices. And that's because we think that's going to give us, it gives us a type of an illusion of control. So what I would say is you do a little exercise where you jot down everything that you think is important to you. You can take several days to do it to make sure you don't miss out on anything. And then at that point, you take that list, maybe 100, maybe 200 things, maybe 15. It doesn't matter how long that list is. Narrow it down to not more than 5. X out everything else. Those 5, do the exercise of figuring out what's the choice that'll help you maximize. What's that choice that you might have less regret? You're never going to eliminate the possibility of all regret. For those 5 domains, maximize. But for everything else, the things that aren't as important to you, you should be making those decisions very quickly, using a satisficing heuristic. You know, I go to a restaurant. If it's really not that important to me, go with the chef's special. I often just randomly choose. I'm not about to spend the time to figure out what I'm going to eat at the restaurant. It's just a meal. It's just an hour. You know, the same thing goes for TV. I mean, if it's, you know, I don't know what to watch, I just turn on the news or pick whatever happens to be the new movie on pay-per-view, because that's not important to me. But you have to understand what your priorities are. And once you understand what your priorities are, then in the domains that matter, I'm going to put in the effort and I'll have more resources to do that. In the domains that matter less, I feel more comfortable just saying, you know what, I'm just going to pick what the other people recommend or randomly choose or just not stress about it. You'll overall be happier.
Is that helpful, Naomi?
Absolutely, absolutely. And at the end, you know, I think one of the very important things is to, and like she said, that I'm going to take home is to really make the decision on what's most important, and those things that are not important, just give myself a time frame to make the decision and be done with it.
Yeah, and remember the driving emotion underneath this is anxiety.
Yes.
And it's anxiety that you have put in the driver's seat, and you've got way too much respect for that anxiety. And somehow you got a formula in your head that if I do this the right way, the anxiety is going to go away. I got good news and bad news. The anxiety is not going to go away.
Right.
So don't let it be in charge anymore.
And I'd like to give a quick kicker for this last subject is that, interestingly enough, My career choice has been actually in sales, because I find it interesting to watch other people go through those decisions for important things.
Yeah.
So, thank you so much.
There you are. Well, good luck to you. Yeah, and thanks for making the choice to call the show and not ruminating about it for an hour. We're going to have to take a short break. We've got a lot of callers that want to talk with you, Sheena. So we will get back to them after our break. My guest is Sheena Iyengar. She's a world-leading expert on choice. She's a professor at Columbia University's Business School in New York City. She's got a new book out called The Art of Choosing. And if you'd like to speak with her, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Tell us about your choices, big and small. How do you make them? Or do you make them? And would you rather other people make them for you? 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Chester County Hospital. How healthy is your heart? Chester County Hospital is offering an online cardiac risk assessment. By answering a few questions, you can learn if you are at risk for heart disease. Online at chestercountyhospital.org.
With its combination of rockabilly, ska, reggae, R&B, and punk, The Clash's landmark release, London Calling, would become one of the greatest rock and roll albums ever recorded.
So on the 30th anniversary of its U.S. release, it warrants a Sound Opinions classic album dissection.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Jacobs Music supports WHYY. Jacobs Music offers Steinway & Sons and Yamaha pianos and piano rentals with option to purchase. Details at jacobsmusic.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about choice today. You've chosen to listen to the show. Lots of you have chosen to call in. Why? How did you make these choices? What went into them? My guest is Sheena Iyengar. She's one of the world-leading experts on choice. She's a professor at Columbia Business School in New York City. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing. And to those of you who are on hold, we will get to your calls, but there are just a couple of questions, Sheena, I have got to ask you before we go to calls. And one is the cultural issues. You've taken a look at that for obvious reasons because of your own background, but you spend a lot of time looking at how different cultures make choice. And specifically, I found interesting your comparison between the Asian and American choices, the me first American, American mentality. Tell us about what you found.
Are you referring to the studies with children?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So one of the things that, I found when I was studying people from different cultures, so Japanese, Chinese, Indians versus Americans, is that when you ask Americans what first words come to mind when you hear the word choice, they invariably think of things like freedom, liberty, American dream. When you ask Asians what comes to mind, they think in terms of responsibility, frustration, burden. And one of the ways in which we see that manifest itself is when you look at whether it be children or workers in the workplace. So I'm going to give you a description of a study done with kids. So you take Asian and American children, Asian and Anglo-American children, and you either give them a choice. So you're doing a bunch of math questions, and I give you a choice. What color marker would you like to use as you're jotting down these questions, your answers to these questions? Versus, I let you decide. Versus I let you get the same choice as your peers, so what everybody else got, or you get the same choice that your mother chose for you, so those are typical other choosers, or your teacher chose. And so the question is, does this affect how well you do on the math assignment and how motivated you are to do more math later on? And you find for the Americans, no surprise, if they get a to choose, even if it's something trivial, like what color marker you're going to use while you're doing your answers to the questions, they perform better. So they actually will do about 20% better on those math questions. They'll even say they like math more. They'll spend more time doing math later when they're no longer required to do so. Regardless of who it is that makes the choice for them, if they're getting the same thing as everybody else, it's their mother, that's really offensive. Regardless of who it is, their performance either remains at zero or it drops. Now, for the Asian kids, you see something entirely different. They perform the best if it's the choice that their mother's made, if they think they get the same choice as their classmates, because they trust that choice. They feel like this must be a good choice if somebody they trust has chosen. They do second best when they choose for themselves. And they do just as badly as the Americans would do if someone whom they don't trust makes the choice, like a stranger or people that they regard as inferior. So if you're fifth graders, third graders, if you get the same choice as third graders, they view that as an insult. What we found is that choice played an enormous role for Americans, but for Asians, it really, what matters more is that the choice be made by a trusted other.
Hmm. That's really interesting. And as we talk later, you did another study about children who were hospitalized in France versus this country, and it really addresses the issue of who makes the choice and who makes us feel better. I want to get to that in a minute, but right on this point about self and other and what informs our choice, we've got a caller here on the line. I think it's pronounced Harry. Do I have that pronunciation?
Yes, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. What
well,
can we do for you?
I got married about 22 years ago. I have two children. One just about to be 14 and the other one just about to be 9. Unfortunately, I got divorced about a year and a half ago. And I made the choice to stay in the country, although I am completely alone in this country. My family is from here, and my wife, ex-wife, is from here. And I made the choice to be here next to my children. It is extremely difficult. I don't have the support system. And I sometimes think I made the wrong decision. I do have some kind of an anxiety. And from time to time, I feel like maybe I should go back to my country. Although I know I will not be happy there. I'll take my answer over the air.
I would. Would you mind staying on the air for just a minute?
Sure, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Sheena?
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
so what would I advise in that case?
Yeah. How would he make a better choice?
Well, it seems to me, in a sense, you're between a rock and a hard place. And I think at that point, you know, you have to recognize that neither choice, there's no magical golden choice here. Regardless of what choice you make, you're losing something, and that's inherent to all, to many of our choices in life, that there are limitations. And essentially, ultimately, the trade-off you're making, I would imagine, is the trade-off between your duty, the sense of duty you have to your children, because they're still growing up, and a duty to yourself, in that you want to live where you have more of a support. And, you know, and then the question becomes, how do you balance that? I mean, you have to recognize that no matter what you choose, you're going to be unhappy. The results are going to be less happy, and there are going to be anxieties, and you simply decide which one's more important, to be near your kids or to be nearer to a support group.
Knowing that each decision involves loss, and all loss must be mourned to a certain extent.
Yes.
I would want to add something else, Hari, and I'm coming at this for you having no idea about your culture, your values, or your personality. But you talked about your anxiety, and you talked about a lack of support system in this culture. And they do play off one another. And being isolated is going to raise your anxiety and your depression, or put you at risk for it. On the other hand, as your anxiety goes up and as depressive symptoms go up, you're going to be less likely, less able to reach out and develop a culture, a support network for yourself. So they really do play out against each other. I was sad to hear you say what you said, and I have no idea what goes into that, but the fact that you remain isolated in this culture after a year and a half. And I would hope that something there could be improved for you some way, somehow. Thank you for your call. I do wish you the best. I want to bring up another question, and this is more provocative study you did, or provocative in my mind anyway. You did your undergraduate here at the University of Pennsylvania with Martin Seligman.
I did.
Father of positive psychology. In one of your research projects, you looked at different religious groups to find out how their perspectives affected their outlook on life, their health, their happiness. Now, we know and have long known people of faith tend to do better, tend to be more resilient. But you discovered that the more fundamentalists who put their trust in God experienced greater hope, more optimism, and more resilience. Tell us more about that.
I was actually expecting the opposite, because here I was, right, you know, trying to deny my Sikh roots and deciding that, well, being a Sikh, it's got so many rules. I mean, this is clearly a recipe to make somebody depressed. And then there was Marty Seligman, who showed that when you lost control over your life, you became depressed. I went to him with this proposal to show that belonging to a religion actually made people more depressed. And he said, well, I don't know if there's such a relationship. So we did this study with members from nine different faiths, ranging from fundamentalists to liberals. So fundamentalists would be Orthodox Jews, liberals would be Reformed Jews. We had nine different faiths, and we found that the members of more fundamentalist faiths were more optimistic, were less prone to being depressed, so that if a negative thing happened in their life, you know, like they just lost their job, they were more likely to feel optimistic about their chances of getting a new job or finding a way to make it work out, whereas the members of more liberal faiths were much more pessimistic, particularly those who didn't believe in God.
When we think, though, and look nationwide or worldwide about fundamentalist groups that we see, they certainly seem less happy, less optimistic in general. So that's why I was surprised to hear those results.
Well, what do you mean when you say they're less happy? Members of fundamentalist faiths are always happy, and I think we at times confuse and conflate their happiness with dogmatism. So, sure, they can be more dogmatic about certain ideologies, but that doesn't make them less happy.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's take a short break, and we're going to get back to calls. And I also want to spend some time talking with you about your medical condition and how that's affected your choices. We're talking about choice today. My guest is Sheena Iyengar. She's a world-leading expert on choice, professor at Columbia, and her new book is called The Art of Choosing. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents the world premiere exhibition Ancient Rome and America, now through August 1st. Showcasing the cultural, political, and social connections between ancient Rome and modern America, the exhibit features a never-before-seen collection of artifacts from Italy and the United States. Ancient Rome and America, now through August 1st, at the National Constitution Center. Details at constitutioncenter.org.
At 67, Ralph Wenzel suffers from dementia, a condition he claims was brought on by injuries he sustained at work. Wenzel's old job? A lineman for the Pittsburgh Steelers and San Diego Chargers. And whether Wenzel receives workman's compensation for his injuries could revolutionize how the NFL treats its players. That story next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about choice with Sheena Iyengar. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing, and she's a professor at Columbia University's Business School in New York City. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Jane on the line. Hi, Jane.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if the professor found any differences in gender decision-making. My children who are now in their 20s when they were little, and we would go into a Baskin-Robbins. My son would be nearly finished with his vanilla or chocolate cone, while my daughter was still asking for samples. It seems that this has continued, and I've noticed in general my husband makes quicker decisions in the grocery store than I do, and was this studied?
So then you're asking, I hear two questions I'd like to pass to you, Sheena. One is a gender question, the other is a genetic question about choice.
Yeah, the genetic question a lot of people have theorized about. They say that there's some people that are born with the maximizing gene, whereas other people satisfies. I don't think there's any evidence to prove that one way or another. You certainly do see, we all know people in our lives that tend to be more maximizers, you know, the people that can never quite decide and they spend all their energies on what might amount to being rather small choices.
Right.
In terms of the gender effect, though, you do find that women are both better and worse than men at making choices. So they are able to memorize or create for themselves larger choice sets, you know, so they can keep track of a heck of a lot more clothing options than say men can, and they have a higher tolerance for dealing with more choices than can men on average. But they also have a lot more choices to make. They both have a lot more choices as well as have fewer choices, and so they actually have a harder choosing environment to work with. So, you know, think about a woman's life. It's actually more complicated than a man's life. When she wakes up, before she goes to work, she has to make a bazillion choices. She has to choose what she's going to do with her face, what she's going to do with her hair, what she's going to wear, and every single piece of what she's going to wear is supposed to be a carefully made choice. Whereas a man doesn't have to worry about all that. On the one hand, we're sort of culturally engineering her or training her to worry about so many more choices than we ever make a man worry about. On the other hand, we also tell her that the trade-offs that she has to make for the choices that she makes are much more consequential than that of a guy. So that, for example, women do save more than men. And that's because I think it's made more salient to them that there's going to be some real problems if you don't save. On the other hand, women, when they are about to have a baby, have to consider the trade-off between their career and their child. And that's not something that men have been acculturated to think about. And that, in a way, it's difficult to know whether you call that a real choice or not. I mean, should women have to make that trade-off in the way that men don't? So I think there's reasons why women end up fixating more than we would like them to on choices that perhaps aren't as relevant. I think we give them that message.
And what can they do to help them get less fixated?
Oh, I would again go back to the advice I gave to the woman earlier. You got to be choosy about when you choose, whether you're a man or a woman. You've got to be choosy, and perhaps that becomes even more important for a woman because she really is going to get even more pressure than a man to make the, quote, perfect choice about everything. I mean, starting from her eyeshadow, you know, down to her career, down to, you know, how she changes the diapers of her baby.
Yeah, I mean, that makes all the sense in the world. Just as an aside, you know, some of those generalizations, I just want you to know that I'm wearing a damn nice outfit today, and I gave it a lot of thought, so... So I just want to put that on the record. You know, you talked about choice and whether sometimes it is real or it's an illusion. You were born with retinitis pigmentosa and you've been blind since high school.
Yes.
I'm paralyzed from the chest down from a car accident for more than 30 years. Now, people tell me that I've made a choice to live a full life despite great adversity. And I can imagine people have told you the same, but none of this, honestly, feels like choice to me. I'm not aware of making conscious choices. It feels like I am just living. So are they seeing choice where it doesn't exist, or am I in some kind of denial about my life?
Well, I can't speak for your experience, but I do think that my being blind, in a sense, ended up affecting the research questions that I researched and the approach I took to choice. You know, growing up, people always pointed out the limitations, right? You know, could I go to a normal school or would I have to go to a school for the blind? Could I study math and science? Could I dissect animals in biology lab? There were always questions about what I could and couldn't do and what I was going to be able to do when I grew up. You know, some people thought I should become a musician or become a lawyer. There were all these stereotyped careers that were out there for blind people. And essentially the question became, well, what choices do I really have? So, you know, on the one hand, in school, I was always hearing this rhetoric that you could do and be whatever it is you want as long as you put your mind and heart to it. But at the same time, there was this reality on the ground which was saying, well, what can you do as a blind person? And I think that what that did for me is it enabled me to develop a language of limitations. It made me understand that choice really had its limitations and that part of the challenge I had in life was in figuring out, you know, what options were available to me. You know, what were the... to separate the true limitations from the perceived ones. And in a way, that was probably a really good thing for me because I ended up focusing on the choices that were really worth it to me, and I only dedicated myself to those choices which I was really willing to put all my energy behind it, because there really were going to be a lot of doorkeepers and naysayers when it came down to what a blind person could and could not achieve. And I think that those constraints enabled me to make the most of the choices that I had.
Be more thoughtful. Be more thoughtful and reflective about your choices.
I think so. When I think back, that's what I think it did to me.
I alluded earlier, Sheena, to a study you were involved in, and about how French and American parents coped with the death of an infant child who was taken off life support. In France, doctors typically make the decision to end the life, whereas here, it's the family who makes the decision. Tell us a bit about what the study showed when people have to make such tough choices versus when others decide for them.
So what we did was we followed French and American parents for up to a year after their newly born infants had died. And in all cases, the life support had been removed. So all these children were born with cerebral anoxia, which means that they lost oxygen to the brain at a critical moment during the labor. And they were all typically premature. And as you mentioned, there was a difference in who made the decision of when and if to remove the life support. What we found is that even up to a year later, the American parents had a much harder time coping with the loss of their infant. So, for example, French parents said things like, you know, Noah was here for so little time, but in the little time that he was here, we learned so much. We gained a different perspective on life. That was what the French parents said. The American parents, by contrast, were saying things like, I keep asking myself, what if, what if, what if I hadn't done that? I feel as if I've played a role in an execution.
And we should say that both parents were informed. They both had a full set of information.
Yes.
And the difference is who decided ultimately.
The difference was simply who decided.
Yeah, I think that's a very powerful study about when we give up our choice to others and when we seek expert opinion and trusted expert opinion and give up choice, even when the stakes are this high. It's a powerful statement. I don't know if that could ever be incorporated into American medicine.
He would be very unpopular here.
Yeah.
Because even though they were more miserable and the American parents felt trapped by the choice that they made, they still didn't want to give up that choice.
Right, right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. Just fascinating subject matter.
Well, thank you so much for reading the book. I really appreciate the
sure.
time I've been on here today.
My guest today has been Sheena Iyengar. She's one of the world-leading experts on choice, a professor at Columbia's Business School. And her new book is called The Art of Choosing. Next week, we're going to be talking about the psychology around climate change, new research showing that Americans don't feel so threatened by climate change. Also, coming up are a couple of events I want to tell you about. On Sunday, April 18th, this coming Sunday at 1 p.m., I'll be talking about my new book, The Wisdom of Sam, at the Philadelphia Free Library Festival. Shortly after that, I'll be at Addis Israel Congregation in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. That'll be on April 20th for a two-day conference being put on by Enable Incorporated. That's a nonprofit enabling individuals with disabilities to live full independent lives. For more information about that, log on to enablenj.org. Well, as always, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been John Knapp. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons and Stephanie Marudis produce the show. Hannah Cope is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.